Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Once again, friends, and welcome to the Fergan. It feels like a seriously long time since I did a monologue episode without a guest. But as this is episode number 30, which is feels like quite an achievement to get to number 30, to be honest. And I do have to extend my sincere gratitude to all of you who have supported this podcast in any way and shared it with other people, spoken well of it with others, or just given it your time. So every 10 episodes, I do an AMA, Ask Me Anything. So about a week ago, I put out a message on the Telegram channel asking for people to submit questions if they have anything that they'd like me to talk about. So I whittled it down to about 10 questions, which I feel that I can say something of interest on, and I'll be going through them in this episode. So yeah, hopefully there's some good stuff in here. I think there will be. There's some really good questions here and some kind of fun ones at the end as well. So stick around for that. So Rob emailed me to ask about the idea of Jesus, of the Abrahamic Christian religion, being part of the pagan mystery cults of ancient Greece. So he says, he sent me a video link to a video. I forget the name of the video right now. I'll put it in the episode description in case anyone's interested. But the video is essentially the idea that Jesus was actually of a lineage that originated in the pagan mystery cults of ancient Greece. And that the, as Rob says, the original Eucharistic wine would have been brewed with psychedelic fungus called ergot. I think it's pronounced ergot or ergo. I don't know. Anyway, so the idea here is that there was a temple, I believe, in Athens called Eleusis. And pagan mystery religion practitioners would go to this temple and they would consume this entheogenic, psychedelic, mind-altering substance, this Eucharistic wine. And the idea of this is that it would almost kind of mimic death. So the video that Rob, who asked this question, the video that he sent me mentions a phrase, if you die before you die, then you won't die when you die. And Rob is asking what I think about this idea of Jesus actually being part of this mystery cult. This actually ties into the Gnostic ideas of John Lamb Lash. And those of you who listened to, I think it was episode 8, was he this? I think it was number 8. Episode number 8 of the podcast, I spoke with, had an in-depth conversation with John Lash and our mutual friend Rob Miller. For those of you who don't know, John is an expert on Gnosticism, but he actually differs from most Gnostic scholars in that he doesn't believe that Gnosticism is or ever was a world-denying religion or spiritual worldview, and that actually it was quite the opposite. It was a world-embracing one. And in my conversations with John, my private conversations, he has let me in on some additional knowledge regarding his idea of Gnosticism. And it's very much related to this sort of mystery cult practice of ancient Greece, where people would consume entheogens, usually in the form of psilocybin, so-called magic mushrooms. And through this, they would actually have a direct contact with the divine, with the divine realm. They would almost see what it's like to die. They would see the other side through this practice. And there's a in the video that this question asker Rob sent me, there's a segment from the Gospel of Thomas, which I believe is one of the so-called Gnostic texts. I might be wrong there, but anyway, the Gospel of Thomas, there's a line apparently that says, "The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and the people do not see it." So this ties in very much with John Lash's view that actually it's this material realm that is sacred and divine, and that spirituality is to be found here. John wouldn't use that word spirituality. He's actually not in favor of it. But the point is that what we experience here in our material lives, this is it. This is our divine experience. We're having it now. And in the video, Joseph Campbell, you know, the famous comparative mythologist, he also talks about how eternity is in the here and now. It's in understanding that the kind of this very moment is divine. This very moment is sacred, and getting the very most out of each moment. And I think that's an important lesson for all of us to learn. As for whether I think that there's any plausibility to the idea that Jesus, the rabbi of the Judeo-Christian religion, as to whether he was actually part of the ministry of this ancient Greek mystery cult, I think that if there was a man who partly inspired the stories of the tales of Jesus Christ, then it would have been may have been someone like this. Whether he was actually named Jesus, I don't know. Christ is a title, an ancient Indo-European title. So, I wouldn't know enough to say that. And to be honest, I'm not really interested in speculating about whether Jesus was real or not. I think that most of what is written about him is probably made up for political purposes anyway. But I certainly am interested in this idea of this Greek mystery cult, this idea of taking psychedelic substances to make contact with the divine. But as I'll go into in a question a little bit later on, it's important for we as pagans to neither deny the material realm nor deny the spirit realm. So I would say, for example, John Lash, with all of the respect that I do have for the man as a teacher, and I would say as a friend now, I don't share his view that there is nothing beyond this material realm as far as any kind of afterlife or soul is concerned. But I also don't share the view, the kind of polar opposite view that many stereotypical or traditional, I guess, Gnostics, those I would say who misunderstand Gnosticism, the world denying ones, the anti-cosmic ones, I don't share their view that this material realm is actually some kind of prison which we should be trying to escape from. And as I said, we'll go into that in the answer to another question regarding Buddhism. So yeah, I hope that offers some food for thought anyway, Rob. So next question is from someone who remained anonymous, and they asked, "My wife is Christian and doesn't accept or really understand my beliefs. We have a newborn and I don't know what to do. What would you do?" I feel kind of like an agony aunt here, but this is quite a common question that I get asked, actually. People email me with these kinds of problems on a fairly regular basis. Now, I don't know what Anon's beliefs are. He doesn't specify what they are, but I'm going to assume that they're potentially heathen or pagan, at least sympathetic to paganism. I actually have a friend who is part of my heathen group that I meet with you know, once or twice a year. And his wife is also a Christian, but she comes along to all of the moots, and she's a lovely person, and he's a lovely person. They seem to have a very strong marriage. They seem to be very fond of one another. They have a lot of fun. They've got, you know, wonderful children. And she doesn't shy away from being involved in any of the rites that we conduct. Now, I know some people may have reservations about the idea of a Christian being involved in heathen rites, but I would take that on a case-by-case basis. And in this case, I have no issue with it at all. I think that I would say from what I know of her, that she's more of a cultural Christian, and she likes the idea of fitting in with the kind of rural Christian community more so than she actually believes in the gospels of Jesus. So from that, you know, with that bit of context, I would say to Anon that it's not impossible for you to be a heathen or a pagan and for your wife to be a Christian. I'd say that there can actually be more serious differences of worldview than that. For example, I would be more reluctant to be in a marriage with someone who bought into the COVID psyop, hook, line and sinker, than I would to be married to a wonderful woman who happens to be Christian. Luckily for me, my wife isn't, and we're able to kind of pretty much be on the same page in how we raise our children. So what would I do? Anon has a newborn, doesn't know what to do. I guess it depends on how much of a problem it is that your wife doesn't accept or understand your beliefs. Is she actively preventing you from practicing them? Is she preventing you from, or proposing to prevent you from initiating your newborn into, you know, your ancestral religion? If she is, then I would say that that's a problem. And it's not even really a problem of Christianity versus heathenry. It's more a problem in the sense that your wife doesn't respect you. And that's a major problem, whatever the difference of worldview is, whether it's religious, whether it's political, whether it's ethical, whether it's, you know, in terms of a traditional family unit. It's problematic if she just doesn't understand you. If she's willing to sit down with you and have a conversation whereby you both agree to disagree respectfully and say, okay, you're a Christian, I still love you. And she might say to you, okay, I accept that you are a heathen, I still love you. You know, let's make this work. I also have a fairly new friend who is a long-standing and very admirable heathen. I believe of a more kind of nationalistic worldview. And he's told me that his wife just doesn't share those beliefs at all. She has no interest in them. But she doesn't prevent him or their children from practicing those things at all. And it seems to me that they have quite a happy family life. So yeah, my answer to Anon there is, it's not really a problem that she's Christian. It's a problem that she doesn't respect you enough to accept your beliefs and to allow you to freely exercise them and to introduce your child to them. So yeah, what would I do? If that was the case, I couldn't personally be married to someone who didn't respect me to that extent. If I was able to sit down with her and have a conversation where we agreed to respectfully disagree and just let each other do our own thing, then, you know, I could remain in that relationship indefinitely. So next question is from someone called Vivian. And by the way, everyone, if you ever do send in an AMA, I'm going to assume if you don't specifically ask me not to name you, that it's okay to name you. So I do apologize if anyone who's asked any of these questions didn't want to be named, but it makes sense to me to name the people asking the questions. So anyway, Vivian actually offered two questions, and one of them is, do you think it is appropriate to give children the names of gods and goddesses? And that's an interesting question, and it's not one that I really have a particularly firm stance on. I remember many years ago when I was posting on forums, and I was just beginning to discover my sense of kind of pagan identity. And for various reasons that I won't go into now, I assumed that my identity was more Celtic. It took me a couple of years to realize that that's not the case at all. Actually, my entire identity that I've been able to trace is Germanic. But at the time, I was under the impression that I should be seeking to induct myself into the Celtic pagan world. And I remember choosing a forum name. There was a forum for Brythonic pagans, and I named myself Tyrannus on this forum. I gave myself the name Tyrannus. Tyrannus is the Celtic thunder god. And very quickly, I was kind of pounced upon by other forum members saying that it was sacrilegious of me to name myself after the god Tyrannus. So this was really the first time I ever encountered the idea that it's not acceptable to name yourself after a god. Perhaps subconsciously, as a result, I've never chosen a pseudonym that is the same as that of one of our gods. Two of my children have names which are in honor of the Germanic gods, but they are not their names as such. So one of them, for example, means beloved of a certain god, and the other one means the peace of a certain god, as in the Frith of a certain god. So they're named in honor of those gods, but they do not share the precise name of those gods. As far as I know, it's never been traditional practice within paganism, certainly not Germanic heathenry, to take the names of the gods themselves. I can't right now think of any examples of where that has happened. I do know a couple of people who were named after the gods, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I can't imagine that the gods would take offense to that. Really, it's quite a kind of grand, almost arrogant thing to do, I would say, to give your child directly the name of a god. But I can't really view it as being insulting in any way. The second question Vivian asks is, do you have any advice for someone who is a heathen and an aspiring homesteader and in a relationship with an atheist who does not share the goals of rural living and self-sufficiency? So this, you know, this very much kind of ties into the question before the last one, the one by Anonymous. And I think I covered quite a lot of it in my answer to that one, but with this question by Vivian, there's the added factor of being an aspiring homesteader and being in a relationship with someone who doesn't aspire to be a homesteader either. Do I have any advice for that? My advice is to be completely honest about your aspirations. Let your partner know just how important it is to you. I don't think that there's anything to be gained by kind of scaremongering or trying to scaremonger them into adopting your views wholesale. I've told this before, I believe, on the podcast, but my wife was not always as on the same page as I am, as she is now. We've been together for just shy of 20 years. And initially, we were actually ideologically somewhat separated. I mean, obviously, we were strongly attracted to another, you know, had the same sense of humor. We fell in love. We've had a strong relationship, you know, since day one, really. But early on, we kind of accepted the fact that we were a little bit different ideologically, excuse me, to one another. But what happened was she, you know, and I don't want this to sound as though, you know, it turns out I was right all along and she realized it. It's not like that, but she gradually came more to my way of thinking. And it's not necessarily because she submitted to my, you know, my dominant view. Although I think there is a factor there where when you're in a relationship with someone that you love and you respect them, then you do tend to gravitate towards their way of thinking. But I think the world changed a lot over the time that my wife and I have been together. And I think she just realized that a certain way of viewing the world was correct. And it just so happened that that was the way that I'd already been viewing the world for quite some time. So I think that that may be the case for you, Vivian, that your partner might, well, I think it's highly likely that a lot of people over the coming years are going to see the worth in living a more self-sufficient homesteading lifestyle. All that you can do is lead by example at this point. So if you're aspiring to be a homesteader and you know you currently don't have the land and you need your partner's support in order to relocate to buy sufficient land, then I would suggest that you just start with what you've got. If you have a small garden, start growing some vegetables in buckets or potato sacks. You know, start, you know, if you have room, get a couple of chickens. Just start doing a few little things like that. Start learning DIY skills. And you don't even need to preach to your other half about it. You don't need to say, you know, I'm doing this, why don't you join me? Just get on with it. Do what you do. Enjoy doing it. And your partner will see, they will see that it's not only good for you, but good for you as a household. And they'll start digging in and they'll start enjoying it. And they'll start thinking, okay, maybe there's something to this. Maybe there is a satisfaction in this kind of lifestyle. So yeah, my advice in situations like that is to lead by example, be the example, be a happy, fulfilled person in pursuing your goals, and others will see that and they'll be attracted to it, and they'll gradually, or maybe even sometimes quickly, gravitate to your way of doing things and your way of thinking. So I think, again, it goes back to this thing of, if you're in a relationship with someone and there's sufficient mutual respect, which there always should be in a marriage or a relationship, then you can find a way to find a middle ground on these things, and you can find a way to come closer together in your pursuit of what interests you and in what you think is important. But if there is such a lack of respect that they mock or deride or refuse to accept that your view is a certain way, then you have problems. And the problem doesn't stem from the fact that that on this specific issue you differ. It stems from the fact that there isn't enough mutual respect there that they will commend you or accept that you're doing something which they don't quite understand. Next question is from someone called Alex. And Alex asks, what are your thoughts on Buddhism as an authentic Indo-European initiatory tradition with a lineage that has not been broken to this day? The nature of Buddhism is naturally integrative, see Japan, and lends itself well to an organic syncretism with folk faith. While from a Buddhist perspective, worshipping the gods would not make sense, except for their enlightened aspects or manifestations, it would still encourage venerating them and the giving of sacred offerings. I think Buddhism harbors great potential to fuel an authentic revival of European paganism, bringing with it a complete esoteric system with imminent, pragmatic and transcendent components and an overarching telos towards enlightenment. So that's a pretty big question. And I will admit that I had to brush up on my understanding of Buddhism in order to give a response to this. So I made some notes on this, and the kind of short answer, skipping ahead a bit here, is no, I'm afraid I don't agree with that, Alex. I with all due respect, I just can't see Buddhism as being any kind of salvation for a European, you know, revival of European paganism or anything like that. And the reasons are as follows. And, you know, perhaps I'm wrong on some of these points, but this is what my quick bit of research turned up. Buddhism has no central deity. Buddhism is an emergent religion, and I don't know if that's the right word, but what I mean by that, and I couldn't find the right word, but what I mean by that is that Buddhism was actually created by a prophet in about, I believe, 500 or 600 BC. Buddhism is transcendentalist, meaning that it rejects the material world. It believes that human existence is suffering and that our goal is to transcend material existence. Let me go back through those first. So it has no central deity. So it's really, well, firstly, the obvious thing to say there is that it can't really be integrated with native European paganism, because native European paganism, the various traditions of Europe do have gods and goddesses, in some cases quite central ones, and it seems to me that Buddhism would reject them or would teach that it is not important to honor those gods. So just straight off the bat there, I don't see how it can be, how it can syncretize with European paganism. I'm always wary of religions that were created by a known figure. Even Zoroastrianism, which I do have some kind of, let's say, sympathies with. I find aspects of Zoroastrianism quite interesting. But that was, again, was a religion that was discovered by Zoroaster, in the same way that Buddhism was discovered by the Buddha, and not even that long ago. So I have to wonder, can it ever be a true religion if it's, or can it ever be truly be a native folk way if it hasn't existed since the mists of time? As far as we know about heathenry, or paganism more widely, as far as we know, the basic principles of the pagan way of life have been the same since European man first existed. There is some assumption to that, you know, we're going on the fact that we don't have information from beyond a certain time, but I do believe strongly that paganism, as has been written down in the earliest source material we have, represents a way of life which our ancestors have essentially always led. The same can't be said for Buddhism. It's transcendentalist. So it, again, it's completely at odds with paganism there, because paganism is not a world-denying worldview. Buddhism is. So as pagans, we do not seek liberation from the material realm. I can't speak for all pagans here, but my view is this, and I believe that this is essentially the pagan cosmological worldview, is that we exist in many realms simultaneously, or an aspect of ourselves does, or we can. can exist in various realms. This is a material realm that we exist, Midgard or Middengard. And it is not a prison. It is not punishment for anything. It is not to be transcended. It is not it is not pure suffering. There is immense beauty, nobility, wonder, teachings, and experiences to be had in this material realm. And it is one aspect of our overarching existence among the many realms. And we should cherish our tenure within every realm of the cosmos. So, yeah, we do not seek liberation. What we do is we seek to make the very most of our material existence in the knowledge that there is an existence beyond this as well. Right? There are aspects of Buddhism which I think are good. You know, it shares this kind of Zoroastrianism, a Zoroastrianist view or practice of right living, right speech, right practice, right acts, right, you know, right thought. So it basically promotes honorable living. And that's something that I believe is shared with paganism, with heathenry. It has virtues which are to be upheld. It has a strong ethical system. And that ethical system in the heathen worldview, it tends to be more subjective. So ethics are what is good for your family, for your community, for your tribe, rather than there being some kind of objective, universal moral code. Whereas Buddhism seems to have a more universal moral code. And I have sympathies with that. I am still learning to be more subjective in my morality, to be quite honest with you. But I'm not sure that I will ever be able to let go of this idea that there is an objective good, and there is such thing as being a good human being. I know that sounds quite kind of humanitarian, altruistic, and whatever, but you know. What can I say? I can't apologize for that. It's just the way that I currently am. So yeah, I think that about answers that question. Well, just to add to that, Alex seems to suggest that European paganism is in need of some outside esoteric system with transcendent components. In order to rescue it somehow. It isn't. I mean, we can look to other things. You know, as many of you know, I do have an interest in the sort of pro-cosmic Gnosticism of John Lash, particularly his idea of the archons, because it seems to explain a problem which is not as clearly explained in our own native lore. There are aspects of Sanatana Dharma, of the Vedic tradition also, which I think are worth looking at and maybe even kind of bringing over and placing within a Germanic or European lens. So I'm not closed off to the idea that we can learn from other systems, but we don't need them to fix our system. We can perhaps use aspects of them to bolster our system, but only if, and this is important, only if those aspects are already compatible with our ancestral worldview. Because our ancestral worldview is intact. There are no questions about that. We're not confused about whether Europeans strive for transcendentalism, whether we're world-denying or world-affirming. We know that we are world-affirming, but with an understanding that there is a more immaterial state of being. We know this. We don't need another religion to explain this to us or to replace that understanding that we already have. So, I'm guessing that Alex, that you are a Buddhist, or that you practice aspects of Buddhism. And if that works for you, then great. But I don't think that we need to try and meld it with European paganism. Next up, we have a question from Charlie of the English Brethren of the Order of the Sacred Manabund. And Charlie sent a question, I believe it was in the previous AMA in episode 20. I must admit, I don't quite remember what the question was, but his question for this episode, and I thank you for this, Charlie, is what is your view on the reemergence of our priesthood, Gothar, and our problem around initiation? More specifically, what are the factors that will be needed for a Gothi to truly be a Gothi? This is a really good question. It's a big question. What is my view on the reemergence of our priesthood? I think it is essential, definitely, because at the moment we have too many lone wolves, and we don't really have a kind of rite of passage initiatory system for people to become spiritual leaders. And that is a problem, because we do need, despite what some people say, there does need to be some kind of authority in these matters. We need people to lead blots and feinings and symbols. You know, we need those people. I know some great Gothis, some excellent leaders, because most people, especially people who are new to heathenry, they're, and I know this from so many of you messaging and emailing me, you're nervous about coming along to a moot and you know, participating in your first feigning or symbol. You feel like you're too lacking in knowledge to be part of that. You feel nervous and perhaps a bit stupid about your inexperience. That, in my opinion, has been one of the main barriers to people becoming practicing pagans. And that's something we need to fix. And I believe that the way to fix that is to have good, strong, sympathetic Gothis, leaders, priests who will take these new people by the hand and will show them how to properly honor the gods, wights, and ancestors, how to perform blots and feignings at the high holy tides. We do need those people, and we don't really have a system to create those people. So so far, priests, heathen priests, Gothis and Githyas have had to self-teach. They've had to adopt that position of their own accord without being compelled to do so by others, purely because no one else is stepping forward. And a lot of the time this works, and we have some excellent people leading rites all over the world already. But I think for heathenry and paganism to grow, we do need more confident, well-versed, knowledgeable, and absolutely dedicated Gothis and Githyas. We do need a priesthood, people who are absolutely dedicated to this. And Thorbjörn Hlaford of the Vinland Riche, who I interviewed in episode number 27, he's the König of the Vinland Riche, so he is the king of Theurdish belief worldwide. And he is undoubtedly a Gothi or a priest to be looked up to and admired. He honors every holy tide. He even wrote a book on the high holy tides. He practices in a very authentic manner. He does so with authority and with a deep knowledge. And if we had a dozen of him in every country, then heathenry would be seriously on its way up. And of course, there are others. You know, we have Mark Perrier, we have Stephen McNallan, we have, I'm not going to, Wolfinger Sunu in England, we have, so many people. If I've not named you, it's not because you're not one of the very best. But yes, it is important, Charlie. I agree. And what factors are needed for a Gothi to truly be a Gothi? More than anything, it's an absolute dedication to heathenry. The last thing we need is someone who is going to step up as leader for a year and then disappear. There are some old Thirdsmen in America who did that, who were authorities and leaders in Thirdish belief, and then they either converted to Christianity or they just disappeared off the face of the earth. That story is replicated everywhere, and that's, I mean, that is the death of a kindred or a hearth. You know, if your leader who you look up to, who has guided you into the religion, disappears or loses their faith, or you know, or proves to be unreliable, or you know, in lacking in frith or something, proves to be an oath breaker or a villain in some way, then they that is the death of a kindred or hearth. You know, it's difficult for people to recover from that, especially if they're new to it, if their leader is that. So I would say that more so than having all of the knowledge or all of the confidence, or you know, I don't know, all of the right credentials, I think by far the most important credential is their absolute dedication to the faith. Right, next question is from Treowin of Harrenden. And I believe Treowin is over in Tasmania. And I thank you, Treowin, for your email and for your question. Treowin is, I believe, is a Thirdsman, so a member of the Thirdish belief of heathenry. And I'm assuming, apologies if you're not a he, but Treowin asks, I have many times heard you speak on the importance of nature worship in our ancestral tradition. What do you think of animism, sometimes defined as the experience of the other than human world as having agency, will, culture, and voice? Do you believe that heathenry is animistic? What are the implications of this? This is a good question. I've got a couple of things to say on this. When I first became interested in paganism, it was via shamanism. And this is because I was never able to grasp the idea of blindly practicing pagan rites just purely because they are traditional. It felt too kind of cold and calculating, too rigid, too, I don't know, I guess lifeless, for lack of a better word. What I was interested in is actually coming to understand the spirit, the divine directly. So shamanism was my first kind of port of call there. That was the first pagan related practice where you were not just invited but expected to have a direct experience with the spirit world. So the earliest kind of books I read related to the practice of paganism were on shamanism and of, well, shamanism is essentially animism. Shamanism is the idea that everything is bestowed with spirit. Everything is imbued with spirit, even a rock, a twig, you know, that your car, even everything. There's a spiritual energy to everything that you can connect with. And that is beyond what the eye can see. I, in my early kind of shamanic practice, my meditations, I did get the sense of this. One of my early experiences showed me the importance of the elements of the you know, earth, fire, water, and air, and spirit. I was shown these things, and I was shown the importance of them. I was shown the spiritual nature of animals. And it's interesting, this idea of animism. It's kind of somewhat synchronistic that it comes up now, because I was discussing with a good friend of mine just yesterday, the idea of, and this is something that Alfred Avery and I went into in the last episode, in episode 29, how the theory of evolution reconciles with heathenry, with the accepted heathen law as passed down to us from the Eddas. And the point I made was that if humans evolved from apes, and that evolution from ape to man, what is what it was acknowledged as Odin Villian Ve giving man breath, holiness, and will, then that implies that apes do not have those characteristics, right? I mean, that's just a logical deduction. So from that point of view, it would suggest that animals do not have this agency, will, culture, and voice that Treowyn mentions in his question. But this, of course, is only based on the idea that that heathenry and the theory of evolution can be reconciled. Of course, if we were to hold the view, just for argument's sake, hypothetically, that for the purpose of this conversation, hypothetically, if we were to hold the view that humans didn't evolve from apes and that we actually originated by some other means, then that then again allows for apes and thus other animals to have those same characteristics of spirit, will, and holiness that humans do, maybe to a different degree or in a different way. But it's only if we try to reconcile, in, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as I've been able to kind of ascertain in my discussions of this topic, it's only if we try to reconcile heathenry with the theory of evolution that we come across this problem, which essentially places apes and animals as non-spiritual beings. I don't believe that that can be the case, because paganism is, I believe, is shamanism in its origins. I think that all of our understanding of the divine comes from our shamanic origins, from the mists of time when our holy men, our priests, our holy women, where they actually contacted the divine directly through shamanic practices, maybe through mind-altering plant substances. My belief personally is that that is where paganism originated. So to my mind, paganism therefore has to have an animistic bent to it. And if we don't see the divine in everything, then I think we'd have to wonder whether there truly is divinity here in Midgard. And if there isn't, then can we ever really contact the gods and goddesses? I don't think so. So, yeah, in answer to Treowyn's question there, what do I think of animism? I think that animism is an integral part of a true, authentic pagan worldview. And do I believe that heathenry is animistic? Yes, I believe that all paganism has to have an animistic element to it. What are the implications of this? I would say, now that's the most interesting part of this question, I think. What are the implications of this? The implications of it are, of course, that divinity is, that our material existence is absolutely soaked in divinity, that there is nothing that we come into contact with that isn't part of the divine, and that we should therefore treat everything as divine, from the most mundane seeming object to the most profound, Thunor initiated thunderstorm. All of it is divine, and we can find meaning and comfort in all of it. So, for example, if you were to, if you're a hunter, then I do believe that in the way of the Native American, for example, or the Siberian hunter, that you should be thanking the animal for giving over its life for your sustenance, for example, because that animal is imbued with spirit, with the divine. And even when we grow things, you know, we should communicate with the plants that are all around us. I would also say that another implication of this is that psychedelic plants, entheogens, that they are an important part of pagan practice, because there is some people call them plant teachers or guides. And I think if you have an animistic worldview, then it's entirely logical that certain plants would be able to guide us in certain understandings of our existence. So yeah, I'm hugely in favor of it, because I think that the divine is here with us all around. It exists within the material, and it also exists beyond the material. Essentially, there is no area of existence, material or otherwise, which is not soaked entirely with divinity. So yeah, on to the next question. And I've actually been looking for, well, there's two questions, and these are less related to paganism or heathenry. And I've been looking forward to these because these are kind of fun. So they're about music. Matt asks me, out of the first 6 Manowar records, which is the best and why? He also went on to tell me that there is a correct answer, but he wouldn't tell me what that is. Yeah, I'm a big Manowar fan. Huge fan of the first 6 albums. I actually really like Louder Than Hell as well. The 7th album, Triumph of Steel, I'm not a big fan of, but the album after that, Louder Than Hell, I think is a great album, to be honest. But anyway, for the first 6 albums, right, so we've got Battle Hymns with the anthemic song Battle Hymn, and we've got Into Glory Ride, and that's got a couple of, it took me a long time to, firstly, I'm going to say that the first album, Battle Hymns, is not my favourite Manowar album. It's good, but I don't think that they'd really found their feet yet on that album. Into Glory Ride, it took me a long time to truly appreciate that, but now I'm an enormous fan of it. I think that I love the production of it. It's got a great, organic, honest, and heavy production. And the vocal performance, I think, by Eric Adams on that one is possibly his best of any record. Secret of Steel, Gloves of Metal, incredible songs. Hail to England next. Now, this is really, really controversial, and a lot of people are not. If you're out there listening and you're a Manowar fan, you're probably going to be ready to, you know, smash your phone or your computer or whatever you're listening to this on at this point. But Hail to England is possibly my least favourite of those 6 albums. I just have never been able to connect with it. There are some okay songs on it, but I don't even think that there's one truly brilliant song on that album, in my opinion. I'm still trying to connect with it. I still listen to it regularly in an effort to kind of get it. But next up, Sign of the Hammer. Thor, The Powerhead, Mountains. Now, Mountains is my favorite Manowar song of all time, both for the music and the lyrics. I adore that song. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Sign of the Hammer is my favourite record. Fighting the World, I have a really, really huge soft spot for that album because it's the first Manowar album I ever heard. A lot of Manowar fans reject it because it's kind of got that almost kind of Kiss-like, radio-friendly, kind of anthemic vibe to it, which is less metal and more kind of hard rock. But I really, really like it, and it's got a couple of brilliant songs on it. I mean, a couple of songs that could be at home on any other Manowar record. Holy War, Black Wind, Fire and Steel. Black Wind, Fire and Steel has got to be one of the fastest, if not the fastest, Manowar song. I really love that record, and I love the sentiment of it as well. Manowar positioning themselves as these kind of dissidents against the world, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of people love about Manowar. Then the last of the 6, Kings of Metal. Hail and Kill, Blood of the Kings. It's a great record. I think I'm going to go... Damn, this is a hard one. I think I'm going to go with Sign of the Hammer. It's between Into Glory Ride or Sign of the Hammer for me on that one. Maybe Sign of the Hammer just edges it for having, in my opinion, the greatest Manowar song on it, Mountains. So yeah, that's my answer. I don't know, Matt, if that matches up with yours. Let me know. Yeah, and then one last question to finish this episode, and then we'll do the riddle. Aaron asks, any updates on your black metal project, Grab? For those of you who don't know, somewhat recently joined an existing Bavarian black metal project called Grab, replacing the guitarist who is no longer a part of that. So myself and the other member of that band, we became quite good friends. I say friends, online friends, via a shared kind of interest in a particular appreciation of black metal, certain bands, of a certain worldview, of a certain black metal attitude. And he really, I invited him to be the vocalist in a new black metal project, which I'm slowly working on. It's not yet named. And I think when he heard my compositions for that album, he really liked the way that I write music. So he invited me to join Grab. Yeah, there's the updates on that. We've got maybe half the album kind of demoed, but we're actually more focused now on preparing for a live performance. There's a one-off live performance by Grab at Prophecy Fest in a cave in Germany in September. And that's going to be my first time hitting the stage as part of a black metal band since my last gig with Winterfilleth, which was in, I think it was February 2020. So shortly before, maybe January, or I don't remember exactly, shortly before the whole COVID thing, you know, changed the music scene forever. So yeah, that's the latest with that. I'll be playing live with Grab as a one-off in Germany in September, and we're working on an album behind the scenes, and I imagine that we'll be recording that probably not until early next year. Realistically, maybe we'll see a release towards the end of next year, something like that. But yeah, I'll keep you updated anyway. Follow my Walkensman channel on Telegram for information about that, because I update people about all my musical activities there on that one. So that's the end of the AMA. Until episode 40, if we get that far, there's no reason to think that we won't. And I thank you all sincerely for sending some really interesting and thought-provoking questions, and I really appreciate all of your messages. Of course, you can go to fyrgen.com, fyrgen.com. There's some merchandise on there, some really good quality stuff. I'll probably have new Fyrgen merch available soon. You can also buy my book, my short story there, which we're actually probably going to be discussing in the next podcast with a new guest. We're going to be discussing the themes of my mythological short story, Fire in the White Stone. So if you want to get ahead of the game there, you could grab a copy from the website, from fyrgen.com or from lulu.com or even from Amazon, as it's up there now. And there's an archive of past episodes. Of course, if you would like to support this podcast to help me keep it running, because it is a lot of work, and I know that so many of you are getting a lot of worth from it. So yeah, please help me to keep pushing it ahead and keep maintaining the same quality that I think it's becoming known for. And you can do that by signing up on Substack, Patreon, or Subscribestar, or just sending a donation either via crypto or, yeah, there are other methods. Buy me a coffee, Ko-fi as well. So yeah, to finish this episode, we'll discuss the riddle from episode number 29. And that one the answer that's suggested is moon and sun. Although apparently others have suggested swallow, sparrow, bird, wind, cloud, and wind. To me, moon makes most sense. You know, if we just have another look at that one, a bright ship of the air, beautifully adorned, bearing away plunder between her horns. Whose face is familiar to all dwellers on earth. Much against her will, she went westward. Dust lifted to heaven. Dew fell on the earth. Yeah, that's quite. It's quite an enigmatic one. That it's really quite poetic. I like that one a lot. But to me, moon makes most sense there. So yeah, for number episode 30, this episode, the riddle is as follows. I'm surrounded by flames and sport with the wind. I'm clothed with finery and the storm's great friend, ready to travel, but troubled by fire. A glade in full bloom and a burning flame. Friends often pass me from hand to hand, and I'm kissed by ladies and courteous men. But when I raise myself with reverence, proud men must bow to me. I bring man's happiness to full maturity. That seems like quite another quite enigmatic one, that one. But yeah, we'll discuss the answer to that one in the next episode of the Fergan podcast. So yeah, as always, I thank you for listening. Please share this around to anyone that you think might find worth in it, who might find it interesting, who's interested in heathenry, paganism, philosophy, or being a dissident in these current times. So yeah, until next time, be well.